Welcome to Leaders Unplugged, real talk with the impactful. I am David Bach. We're coming to you today from Davos. It is the final day of the World Economic Forum 2026. It's been quite the week. Record attendance, 66 heads of state or government, 400 political leaders, close to 1,000 CEOs, many tech pioneers, leaders of some of the most important nonprofit and civil society organizations, the largest U.S. delegation in the history of the forum. And the theme was the spirit of dialogue. I think there was a sense that there was a lot of need for the world to come together and exchange and listen to one another. And it's been a really interesting week, of course, very much overshadowed by the debate over the future of Greenland, questions over a rupture in the transatlantic partnership, contesting visions of world order laid out by Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, and President Donald Trump, who attended this annual meeting. We'll get into all of that. And when I say we, I mean my friend and colleague, Julia Binder, who's here with me. Julia attended the forum today as a young global leader. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you so much, David.
You're exhausted. How are you doing?
Really exhausted, but also very grateful.
Okay. It's been an intense week. We want to talk a little bit about what some of the conversations were and what our own takeaways are. But I thought we should get started by just setting the scene a little bit. We're still here in Davos. Most people are sort of heading home at this point. Julia, can you just give a sense of what happens to this town during the week of the annual meeting?
I think it's super interesting. The entire town transforms into a big, big Congress Center. So the Congress Center is just one of many locations that are actually really relevant in where discussions are taking place. So I think many are thinking that this is really just about the Congress where the so-called elite meet. But actually, there's so many more conversations, what some call the shadow WEF, in all the houses around. So the funny thing is you will really struggle to find food because all the bars, restaurants, and even supermarkets are rented out to some of the big delegations, to some big companies who host their own events, who stage conversations with many of the people that are also in the Congress Center. So the entire town, everyone who lives and works here is part of the whole event.
I think this is really fascinating, this idea of houses, right? So there is the Nigeria house and the Brazil house and the India house and, you know, the AI house led by our friends at ETH and EPFL. There's the Microsoft house and the E.T. Kearney house and the SAP house. And of course, you know, all of the media outlets are here. And so you literally walk down what should be the main street of Davos. You should have stores and restaurants, and you just have all of these convening spaces right around the main forum headquarters.
They say it's the biggest conference in the world just because you have so much happening outside as well. And I think the biggest challenge, I think, is to really choose your battles. Where do you want to be? Because you will definitely miss out on many important conversations. And I think what I completely underestimated is the time that it takes to get between different locations. You constantly walk. There is no way that you can drive in the city. So basically you walk, what did you have, David? 18,000 steps?
18,000 steps was my average during the week.
I can't match that. I have 14,000. But still, it's way over my usual.
And of course, you know, you're not just walking. You're walking in an alpine resort. There is like ice and snow everywhere. And then you bump into a Nobel laureate or a CEO while you're trying to navigate the ice, trying to get from one place to another.
Or in your case, Katy Perry.
I did see Katy Perry. This is very exciting. And I think I earned some street cred with my kids. So let's talk a little bit more about the substance of the conversations here. We have slightly different agendas, which I think is good for our listeners. So a lot of headlines, right? Greenland, transatlantic rupture, what's going on? There are many other conversations taking place that perhaps didn't receive as much attention. As you were thinking about the week, what happened? What were the conversations that you were a part of that you thought perhaps didn't get enough attention amidst all of the focus on geopolitics?
Yeah, I mean, maybe one word on geopolitics, and I hope that you will tell us a bit more about your impression there. But I mean, the big winner is clearly Mark Carney, right? It's so interesting. He's like the number one topic wherever you go. The Canadians are so proud. They introduced themselves, "I'm from Canada now," in their first sentence. So I think that was the big unexpected winner. But I think what was interesting is the convergence of topics. So usually what you have a lot of topics that happen in side rooms and they're loosely connected. And I think what we've been seeing this year is A, and maybe that is to reassure us, it's not that the sustainability conversation is dead. It's happening under different terms. It's reframed, right? It's happening under critical minerals. It's happening under energy transition. And I think what is super interesting is here the convergence between all the talk around AI and how really everything we talk about AI and scaling AI is now depending on energy, and how everything we talk about energy is very much dependent on materials. Because if we talk about energy, let's say renewables, we need to talk about storage, so we talk about batteries. And a lot of the conversations we then had is, okay, if we talk about materials and resources and rare earths, or as Trump said, rare processing, where he's actually right, then we really need to talk about circularity. So full circle to the topics that I'm very passionate about. So I think what we're seeing is a very interesting convergence of the whole topic of AI, sustainability and geopolitics, maybe in ways that never have converged before.
I completely agree. I think energy was really front and center to so many of the conversations. I attended a session of Jensen Huang, the NVIDIA CEO, with Larry Fink, and Jensen explained, look, there's sort of five layers to AI. The base layer is energy. Before we even get to, you know, chips and, you know, data centers and cloud computing and LLMs, it's energy. I remember I was in a different session, you mentioned, you know, geopolitics, where one of the speakers, you know, really thoughtfully, somebody from South Asia, said, look, the world is sort of dividing into two groups, the petrostates, and it seems that the US, at least for the time being, has decided it kind of wants to be a petrostate. And then there are electrostates, yeah. Right? And those are the large emerging markets, well, they're no longer emerging markets, you know, China, India, Europe betting heavily on electrification while other parts of the world continue to bet on fossil fuels. So it's interesting how energy was really central to so much of the conversation, and it connects geopolitics, AI, sustainability, competitiveness. You know, I read somewhere a title of a session, you know, the physical economy is back and energy is right in the heart of it.
Yeah, and I think this is, despite all the backlash or pushback that we're talking about, when we talk about what will actually power our future economies, it will still boil down to energy. And was a very interesting dinner last night, one of the biggest or the biggest solar producer in India. We had the Indian energy minister there. We had a Nobel laureate there from economics, right? So very interesting conversation. Microsoft was there. So basically, really, these conversations, they really converge. And there is this realization that those that will win the race for AI are the ones that manage energy better. So it's really, again, the topic is front and center under a different umbrella. But I think that was, for me, the interesting insight. And we talked a little bit about Elon Musk's speech, which...
You were in the room, right?
I was in the room,
spoke, yeah.
And, you know, I'm a bit critic in a sense because of his big, big turn from being a sustainability leader to being more in the political sphere where we can agree or disagree. But I think what was interesting in the speech yesterday, and I think this is a big strategic thing to watch, is when he mentioned that SpaceX and Tesla will go into solar production.
Yes.
So imagine now more tech companies, Microsoft and others, will actually not want to depend on others on energy. What if they enter the energy space? This will be so interesting to watch.
And the case he made for solar was not based on saving the planet.
No.
Right? It was economics.
Hard economics.
Yes.
Very hard economics.
And in fact, you know, he combined all of these things. I mean, I have to admit, like he sort of again sort of just stretched people's imagination a little bit and said, look, the best place actually to put data centers is in space. You have abundant solar energy. You have, first of all, abundant space, you have solar energy, and you have cooling. And so put data centers in space rather than on Earth and power them with 100% renewables. And I don't know if that's going to happen. Of course, he has this sort of tendency to talk about things and then some happen and others do not. But again, to your point, that what used to be totally separate conversations and where the sustainability conversation was often perceived wrongly, I think both of us agree, as being juxtaposed to growth, competitiveness, prosperity, and so on, it was very much the key to it.
And to your point, at this Indian dinner last night, what was so interesting, we also had the head of the International Energy Agency, and what he said was super interesting. He said 10 years ago, India spent for $1, it spent on coal, it spent $1 on renewables. 10 years later, it's $1 on coal, $4 on renewables. And at the same time, they're one of the fastest growing economies. I mean, they're fourth largest economy already. They aspire to be third largest soon. So they really see it as compatible. And I think maybe that is the different mindset that we have in Europe or the US, where it's often seen as incompatibles, right? So a particular sustainability and or energy and economic growth. And I think in many ways, what I also found interesting criticism in some of the Indian conversation I had throughout the week is that they said oftentimes the WEF is more of the Western Economic Forum. And I think what we've been seeing is that more and more that we get the Middle Eastern perspective, we get the Asian perspective, and that it really changes the conversation in fundamental ways, and I think in important ways.
No, I think that's right. And I think one of the unfortunate dimensions of the strong focus on the transatlantic relations. And look, it was incredibly important. The transatlantic partnership is central to global peace and prosperity. All the key stakeholders were here. It made a lot of sense that that consumed a lot of airtime. But man, there's so many issues elsewhere in the world. You know, peace and conflict. Think Ukraine, you think Gaza, you think Sudan, you think elsewhere in Africa. But, you know, didn't talk that much about economic development on the continent, for example, you know, human rights, moving education forward, you know, what's next on public health. But many of the people who are working passionately on making progress were here, and maybe those conversations didn't happen on the biggest stages, but they were taking place both in the Congress Center and on the side. So I just wish they'd gotten a little bit more airtime and attention, given, you know, how much political and sort of business and intellectual power was concentrated here in Davos.
Yeah, and I think what is interesting is particularly what you're saying here is I think there's often this assumption that the WEF is only for the biggest businesses and the heads of state. Mm. If you walk through the Congress Center, it's actually not true. I mean, you see the David Beckhams and you see, so like literally stars from all walks of life, but you see a lot of human rights activists. You see young leaders, global shapers. I mean, we always make fun, young global leaders are not that young, but the global shapers are actually very young. They're under 30. You even had, I met an 18-year-old that is from Davos, to really represent also civil society in these conversations. So I think there's oftentimes this perception that this is far from everyday people's kind of lives. But I think there is actually much more happening in the side rooms, which are oftentimes much more actionable than the big stage. Because the big stage is, it's providing a stage for big voices. And it's important as well. But I think also if you look at the Greenland deal and others, this didn't happen on the main stage. It happened in many of the bilateral rooms. So I think a lot of the magic actually is happening in the bilateral rooms and actually unintentional oftentimes. So I think oftentimes for me, the most important insights, they weren't intentionally seeking some kind of consonant or whatever, but really serendipitously running into someone and understanding that there's actually much more we could do together.
Mm. You mentioned the young global leaders. You're a young global leader. This was your first year in this 3-year period of being a young global leader. Not that you stopped being a young global leader after that.
I stopped being young at one point.
Well, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder. Take it from somebody who's a bit older. Talk to us a little bit about what are young global leaders and how did you, as part of this community, perhaps have a different vantage point than on some of these conversations?
Look, I think the young global leader, what is interesting is, yes, you need to have some achievement to kind of be selected as a young global leader. But I think what they select more on is what they see as a potential impact that you may have in the future. Mm-hmm. And it was really the vision of Klaus Schwab to say, we need to represent the voice of future generations at this Congress, which I think was really the intent back as we just celebrated 20 years of YGL. So has been around for a while. I do heard the story that one time he met the young global leaders and said, they aren't that young. And this is where the global shapers came into place then. So I think what is really interesting is, again, it's not a homogeneous group of people. They come from all walks of life. They come from all places. So I had Mongolia, Nepal, Japan, Nigeria, of course, Europe. But I think what is interesting is really the diversity, not just in demographics, but also what they represent. We have actors, we have NGO representatives, we have investors, we have academics. And I think, again, it's that kind of heterogeneity that really adds to the conversation. And look, from my perspective, what is very nice is you're coming to a Congress that is extremely vast and large, and you always seem to have like a community that you can go to. So that is really, it's very helpful to kind of have a go-to person wherever you go. And I think for me, that really facilitated conversations and getting a foot into the door.
At IMD, we take pride in the fact that what we do in our programs, in our classrooms, in our writing is close to practice, it's relevant, it's impactful, it's informed by research and rigor, but we try to be sort of fairly close to the conversation. Are there things, thoughts, maybe still not fully formed that were triggered here this week that you think are going to find their way into your classroom this year?
Yeah, so much. I mean, my head is spinning. Honestly, I have so many thoughts. I don't even know what to prioritize. So I think our media and communication team will be nervous when I come out with my 10 next articles, just because I need to write down everything that I've experienced this week. Look, so many conversations, I might be biased, but in many ways, what you just said got reinforced really here at the WEF, because we were contributing to a lot of the conversations.
Yes.
And I think it was really, really welcome to have an academic voice that is so close to what is actually happening in real life. So I got this comment so many times that CXOs of all walks of life said, Yes, you're putting your finger exactly right in the mouth. So you're really at the, what we're experiencing, this is reflecting what you're saying. And I think we're coming from this perspective where we can zoom out. And I think this is where we're different from almost everyone else, whereby CEO or whatever knows their business, their industry super well, knows what is happening there. Other academics know the link to theory very well. What we see is these conversations happening across industries, across CXOs, and then finding a pattern of what is actually going on. And that was very much valued in the conversations that I have.
And we should say that it wasn't just us here this week. We had 10 colleagues here participating in conversations about how to accelerate the important work on gender parity, how to increase the share of women on corporate boards. Other colleagues looked at how companies can build geopolitical muscle to build competencies. Sustainability, how do we take it forward by putting customers at the center? Competitiveness, always an important topic that IMD contributes to with our World Competitiveness Center and the team there. How do we make sure we build AI systems that are inclusive and aren't biased? So as you say, lots of important conversations that IMD experts contributed to. And I agree, there's something about the sort of rootedness in rigor and in research that we bring, but a curiosity about where current practice is and that ability to perhaps see patterns that gives us a distinct vantage point from which to contribute.
No, and I think this is exactly what was reflected in many of the conversations. And you asked, what will I bring back into the classroom? I think a lot. I mean, again, the sustainability conversation was very much dominated by this perception that there is a pushback, there is a backlash, it's not as relevant anymore. And I can tell you it's quite the opposite. In all the conversations I have been, they may not use the same language anymore. The ones that retreat are actually very rare. Most reframe and many reinforce.
You've written an article about this. What do you call it?
Quiet corporate activism.
Okay.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And this is where many were actually nodding their head and said, yeah, this is what is happening. We can't speak out at the moment, but actually our actions not just continue, we're doubling down, we're putting more money on the table. Yeah. And I had so many CEOs coming to me and say, I'm disappointed that sustainability is not more visible on the agenda. And honestly, I may be not that disappointed because I think we need to mature the conversation. It needs to be a means towards an end. It needs to be part of our competitiveness. It needs to be part of our economic growth agenda. It cannot be a separate side agenda that whenever we get some headwinds, we kind of venture on and now focus on AI. I think it needs to be much more deeply embedded, and this is where we're getting to. And Johan Rekström, I was on one of the panels with him, which is one of my, let's say.
Just tell people who Johan is. I mean, everybody should know him. But
yeah, Johan Rekström is basically the scientist behind the planetary boundaries, and he calls attention to the fact that we have breached 7 out of the 9 planetary boundaries. And I was in one of the sessions with him together, and basically he said, we will look back in retrospect and say this was an important tipping point. 26 may actually be the one where we already start tipping. And in many ways, remember this quote, the old world is dying and the new world is struggling to be born. It's the time for monsters. I think in many ways that could be the theme of this year's Davos. So I think in retrospect, I think we're already at the tipping point. And so it does feel sometimes intense and we struggle, but it's an important part of maturing the conversation.
For me, one thing that I'll bring back into my classrooms, my sessions, is there's sort of a different approach to global affairs emerging that, one contributor, I think it was Alexander Stubb, the president of Finland, called it values-based realism. Others called it principled pragmatism. I think that was the way people captured the essence of what Mark Carney said. But the idea that you don't have to give in to pure power and force and sort of might makes right, which is one vision that is articulated. I think most strongly recently by Stephen Miller, President Trump's advisor for just about everything, it seems now. So that's one view. It's just about power and force. And of course, there's perhaps the somewhat romantic view is it's about rules. It's the rules-based order, institutions, and norms. And I think everybody here agrees that is probably now officially gone after the events of this week. But I think what Stoop, what Carney, what other European leaders, Macron, but not just European leaders, I just make Carney a European leader. But I think it is because of these shared values where you recognize that, of course, as we conduct foreign affairs, a commitment to democracy, the rule of law, human rights, free speech, self-determination, respect for sovereignty need to remain, right? So that's the values part. But you have to be clear-eyed about the role that power and power politics play. And you have to be willing, I think that's what both of them convey, to work with countries that may not share all of your values, but when it comes to ensuring that trade happens based on a set of rules, you can work together. Or they recognize that planetary boundaries are being exceeded and we need to do something about that. And so we need to accelerate collaboration. So, you know, I don't know if I like the term values-based realism best or principled pragmatism. Maybe we'll do a synthesis and we'll call it a values-based pragmatism. But I think this is something that I'll continue to think about. And it is something that could guide business leaders as they make decisions just as much as political leaders.
No, 100%. And I think maybe in the end of the day, what we also see is that Europe is coming closer together. We see that Canada is coming closer to Europe, not geographically, but value-based wise. So I think maybe it's also, again, just let me zoom out in the global perspective. Not everybody benefited equally from the old global order, right? So there were many countries that felt that this is not a very inclusive old global order.
Yes.
So in the end of the day, I hope we're not going to a three-power structure of Russia, China, and the US, but I hope that Europe finds its strength and voice, and maybe it's exactly that kind of push that was needed, because in many ways, as Europe, we were always thinking Germany first, France first, Spain first, whatever. And maybe we really need to think Europe first and say, what does it mean? What are the implications? And I think it's an interesting time. And I came here and at the Young Global Leaders, they asked for what is our hope for the week? And I said, I want to regain hope. And in many ways, I think this was achieved because we had powerful speeches from Europe that were oftentimes lacking. We were oftentimes just the second voice after the US. And I think we're starting to find our voice in a maybe new world order that in the end of the day may be more inclusive because it's not just the US dominating the agenda.
I think that's right. And business has a really, really important role here to help not just Europe, but the world achieve greater resilience. And, you know, that is about how do we build infrastructure that is resilient and secure. You know, we've talked about energy, but it goes beyond that. How do you build resilience into your supply chains, right? When it comes to food, when it comes to medicine, how do you strengthen civil societies to reduce conflict? So, you know, and nobody else is going to do it for us. And so it's time that leaders in business, government, civil society, and in the countries that put a set of values at the core of their activities, you know, that they roll up their sleeves and join forces and do this together.
Yeah, and I think one of the important, at the welcome speech, Larry Fink said something important. He said, many feel left out of this conversation and there's an increasing distrust in institutions. And that is something that worries me a lot because you're mentioning important role of business, of course, but academia, science, right? Important role. Political institutions, very important role, but there's an increasing distrust and polarization. So I think we also need to really, really question our own role and say, how can we be more inclusive in how we really take part in these and shape these conversations that need to be science-informed and based, but really reach and speak to the people that need to get the message.
You said that at the beginning of the week, your goal was to leave at the end of the week with some hope and that you achieved that. I feel the same way. I leave with a lot of optimism. I mean, obviously, the challenges are daunting. But there are so many conversations that pointed to solutions, to opportunities. And so I think in that way, the theme of the World Economic Forum annual meeting, a spirit of dialogue, what Borge Brende and his team set out to do, to bring people together at this critical moment and have them listen to one another and learn from one another, it really delivered. And I mean, let's be clear, there were a lot of conversations where there wasn't enough dialogue, where, you know, some people were talking and perhaps there wasn't enough sort of response. But as a whole, there's a lot of dialogue. There were a lot of new perspectives. There was disagreement. And yet I leave feeling that there was more agreement on more issues than I thought. And that's really important. And so that dialogue really came through. And I think it's going to be so important in a world that is certainly not going to become easier. It's going to remain bumpy. So having places where we can come together and share points of views and perspectives, even if we disagree with one another, is so incredibly important. So as you know, I'm a big fan of optimism. And so I do leave with that optimism. Optimism does not mean that you're sort of dreaming about the future. You have to be clear-eyed. But I think it is confidence in our ability to find solutions to problems that should be driving us forward, as opposed to resignation because the challenges are so big.
Couldn't agree more. And Klaus Schwab apparently once said to the young global leaders, if you don't have optimism, who should have optimism? Because you're shaping this future. And I think this is on us to create this future that we want to see and feel back a sense of agency. I think that's super important. If we don't feel this as those that were privileged enough to attend this and get an insight into this, then honestly, I don't know who should. And I never thought I would ever in my life again quote Elon Musk, but I really love what he said. I'd rather be an optimist and proven wrong than a pessimist and proven right. So I think that's somehow an important message in these times where cutting through the noise can feel daunting.
This is a great place to leave it. So on Monday, that's what we're going to do. But before then, the weekend, what do you most look forward to?
Sleep.
Okay. There you go. Thank you so much, Julia, for this conversation.
Thank you, David.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation and found it insightful. If you like Leaders Unplugged, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and tune in again for our next episode. Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Delia Fisher, Caroline Copley, Frank DeBoring, Felix Zeltner, and Rabia Dibuz. I'm David Bach. See you soon.